day, designed to end weeks of fighting along their border. It took effect at noon local time and calls for an end to all military movements. Both sides also agreed to commit to the original ceasefire in July, brokered by President Trump. Today's deal also calls for the return of civilians to their homes who were displaced by the fighting. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal
Well, we've got that post-Christmas vibe going here on the Augustana College campus. But friends, you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Aubrey Barnes from Young Lions Roar and many other pursuits we'll learn all about. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on WVIK for local radio, the way it's meant to be brewed on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Well, Aubrey Barnes, I want you to know, I don't have many repeat guests, but I enjoy your company so much. This was a no-brainer. And thank you for coming in. This is always a busy time. We've got family around.
Oh, yeah.
We're trying to get those last end-of-year things done that we said we were going to do.
Oh, yeah, yep, the end-of-the-year hustle and all, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm grateful to have you. And you may know Aubrey Barnes as Mr. Aubs. He is an educator, a poet, a writer, a thinker, and I think just a wonderful force for positiveness in our community.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for taking a few minutes to be in with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on again. Like, that's an honor in and of itself. Yeah.
Well, for those who didn't hear you last time you were here, because it's been a little while.
Yeah.
I want to go over the basics if we can.
Yeah.
We're both locals, right?
Mm-hmm,
yeah, you
absolutely.
Grew up around here?
Yep, grew up 3-4 blocks from here, actually.
Yeah.
Not far from Augustana.
Right. Well, same here. I was just on the other side of Lincoln Park.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You weren't that far then.
No. I guess I always tell people, you know, a lot of times when you go off to college, your parents give you really good advice. And mine just said, look both ways when you're crossing the street. Wound up over at Augustana.
Look at that.
But you went to Rocky, right?
Yep. I went to Rock Island High School. Yeah.
See, I always thought that Rocky had a very, very strong program in language arts and English. I think that remains the case today, but I'm grateful for the thoughts and literature, especially that I was introduced to in high school that I would find out other people didn't encounter until much later. What was your experience like at Rocky?
Yeah. So my biggest intro into what really got me more into the creative arts than I was, because I started writing poetry and kind of found my interest and fondness of poetry when I was 11 years old. But when I was at Rocky, there was a teacher who still teaches there, Miss Johnson, mind you, who really kind of showed me poetry on a whole different end, you know, and even kind of made connections to like poetry and kind of showing the poeticness and music that I listened to at the time and kind of showing how there's poetry in that. You know, she would go over Tupac's Brenda's Got a Baby and kind of show us the poet like the poetry in that, and she would also have poets come to her classroom to like read poetry. And that was like my first, you know, being somebody who was already like into it, I already had that draw like naturally, but then when I saw poets who like would come to our class, it would always be like, oh wow, like there's people who do this as a thing, this is kind of cool. But she was the one who really kind of like shifted my perspective on poetry, you know, at Rocky. And it's funny because we're actually working together now for a program that I'm starting at Rocky when school starts back. So to kind of see it go full circle is pretty cool, actually. Yeah, but she was my big catalyst into like poetry and what it could be.
Yeah. But let's do start. How did you get started in this? Because a lot of people will fiddle around with writing and poetry, but for you, it seems early on it was a deeper pursuit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How did you start and how did you start to make that discovery that it was going to be deeper.
Yeah. So how I first kind of like encountered it was really just being in junior high and kind of being the kid that I was. Like I was very shy. Like I didn't like talking to people, like to a point where I'd write notes to friends during the day and hand them to them during the day. And like we'd do the whole handing back and forth. But I would just, it would, like talking to people like was nerve wracking to me, but I had a lot of stuff to say, you know? So when I first encountered rap music when I was in junior high, like Nas was one of the first artists I really encountered. And I would listen to, and this is before obviously like Spotify, iTunes, and all that, where I'd record a song for like 30 seconds on my little recorder and just listen to it over and over walking to school. And I would just hear the stories that he'd tell, like, oh man, this is actually really cool. But I didn't think that I was like musically inclined like that. So I was like, I want to write though, you know? So I'd write stories about things that I experienced as a cross-country athlete in junior high, how my days were at school, the feelings that I was feeling that I couldn't describe. And I just naturally just started just writing. You know, there wasn't really like a poetry book or poet, but I just, you know, found this inclination through music, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There is, I want to go a little bit deeper if I may, because there's that level of writing that is personally satisfying, that helps us to sort of bring things into focus or look at things differently. But then there's that aspect of poetry especially that I think is not only catalytic but cathartic. It changes the listener, right? And that's a heavy burden.
Yeah.
And you were young when you were doing this, but at what point did you start to realize that it wasn't simply about getting these words from yourself to a piece of paper or a recording or something like that, but this would have something that others could benefit from, and that in enable, well, we'll get to that one later, but that, when did you start being cognizant of an audience?
Yeah, it wasn't until my early to late 20s, I mean, early to mid 20s, that I really kind of realized that, you know, I didn't start share, even though I had written poetry all from age 11 till I was 22, 23, like I never really shared it out loud. You know, it was always the thing I kind of just kept to myself. I probably let friends read it every once in a while, but for the most part, it was always kept for myself. But when I first started like sharing it when I was 22, 23 years old, I did it just off the strength of just like, it was fun to me. I liked sharing my stories and all that. So I still wasn't really cognizant of like how it was impactful to the person or audience. But it wasn't until I was like 26 when I was doing this show in Peoria that I was featured at. And I had this older gentleman come up to me after, like he was like a towering 6'4" over me and all that. And he just came up to me and he was like, man, I'm not going to lie, I don't really cry, but that poem you did made me cry, you know? And I was like, it was in that moment that I started really realizing that like there's a power behind this creative ability that I've kind of like grown fond of over the years and kind of like really kind of honed and all that, you know? So when kind of figuring that out, it made me more, all the more like cognizant of like, not that it was always there. I felt like I was always writing about things that were meaningful, but when you understand like how it impacts people, you kind of like are present with your art in a different way, you know, where you're almost a lot more bolder in how you speak truth and just even more assured that like, that it's doing something, you know, right? Regardless of like our inner critic or our imposter syndrome, it's like, you know, it's always doing something, you know?
Sure. Well, and then I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. So after Rocky, what was next?
Yeah. So, when I left Rocky, I went to college in Fort Dodge, Iowa, Iowa Central Community College, and I went there off of a cross-country and track scholarship.
Got it.
So that's really what carried me kind of through school. But I still had like heavy interest in writing to the point where my first major in college was creative writing. I didn't think I was going to do what I'm doing now. I just knew that I wanted to write. Right. You know, I was like, I just know I want to do this thing. Wherever that leads me is wherever it leads me, you know. But even it's funny, I tell people this story all the time, but the winter of my freshman year of high school, when I kind of came back for break and all that, like I had conversations with family members who were like, I don't think you're going to make much off of creative art writing being a major. I think you should switch to something that like is actually like, you know, profitable and all that. So I switched education, like, you know, but it's funny kind of looking at hindsight because like creativity is what I do as a career now. So it's like, you know, as long as I stayed with that desire to do it and had that willingness to do whatever that meant, you know, it created itself. But yeah, so I majored in education, did that through all my, pretty much all my school experience after that. After Iowa Central, I went to Morningside College, but then that was a little far from home. So then I just came back to St. Ambrose and went to school, continued going to school for education. But after my fourth year of college, I was like, I still have one more year and all that. And I was like, I don't know if I really want to do education. So I left for a year after that. And that's where poetry, you know, spoken word poetry kind of really came into the fold in that year off.
Yeah.
And really kind of like seeing, oh, dang, this could actually be something, you know.
And as we will discover, education is still very much a part.
Yeah,
absolutely. What's going on? Well, I want to push back a little bit just because, you know, as a liberal arts guy myself, so any kind of writing is going to help any student in any kind of pursuit, anything, because of the distillation it does for our thoughts, the discipline it gives our thoughts, right? Its ability to help us coalesce data. So even in the sciences, the ability to write effectively, clearly, concisely, all that kind of stuff is critically important, which is a part of, I think, every or should be. So I'm sorry if that got poo-pooed a little bit, because I've heard the same thing. I've heard the same thing 100 times. But if you have that, you really got a leg up and over those who are not as adept at communicating. And when I mention the sciences, I do that intentionally, because part of your work has been very intentionally engaging with science, technology, engineering, math programs. And I think you were just recently doing one at a STEAM lab somewhere.
Tell
us about how that kind of congeals in your calling, in your pursuits.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I'm actually in grad school right now for creative writing through the school called Maharishi International University. And a lot of kind of like what I've been learning through the founder of the school, Maharishi Maresh, is that like literary arts, it is very scientific. You know, it is a very scientific thing. I think just us as kind of like, you know, Westerners and all that, with how we understand art, we just see it as like a quote unquote artsy fartsy thing, you know, but it's way more than that. You know, it's, I tell my students all the time that like, if I didn't do art as a career, like it would still benefit me from like what I've learned about myself, like as a person through it, like what I've learned, like on a self-awareness level of just understanding my thoughts, of understanding how like words work and like in a scientific way, how words like impact certain places depending on how you use them. And just like when you get down to the intricacies of like the syllable count and all these things, you know, there's a science to it, you know, but all that, it takes critical thinking and comprehension, which like, even if I wasn't applying that to writing, like the fact that I get these skills from writing, the critical thinking, comprehension, and asking myself questions and being a solution finder, you know, in very conventional and unconventional ways as well as a creative, like all that impacts, all that comes from art, you know, even on a broader spectrum, like it could be painting, it could be, you know, it could be drawing, it could be all these arts, like they do the same thing. It just is dependent on the creator to understand how to fit these things into these different spaces, you know?
Well, I want to dwell on that a little bit. You're talking about this sort of scientific discovery, and I think there's something about when we encounter words that create a new or unexpected connection, right? I think that does something for us both intellectually and spiritually. A couple of weeks ago, I was mentioned a poem on this program called Coats. And the poem is basically about a man walking out of a hospital with two coats, right?
Oh,
and, yeah. And so the implication that he's leaving someone behind. Right. And then when you come to that epiphany, I think it's Mary Oliver. I'll try to check on that before we get too much further. But when you're just reading these words, these shadows on a piece of paper, and then all of a sudden, oh, that's what it is.
Yeah.
The epiphanous nature of literary arts is that's something that transcends lots of different fields and pursuits. I mean,
absolutely.
And takes us into the sciences.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and like I said, it just like, I think as Westerners, we just never grew up seeing art like that. We just saw art as like, you know, art is just art. It's hobby. It's side job, but it's like, it really is a thing that activates like something that's transcendent and something that kind of like allows us to become more critical thinkers, more comprehensive people, and like more problem solvers. You know, a lot of creatives, you know, when you think about like things like the Black Arts movements, like the Black Arts Movement or the Harlem Renaissance, mm-hmm. a lot of these problem solvers during these times were creatives, you know, mm-hmm. poets, writers, you know, thinkers, W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, Langston Hughes, all these, even Dr. Hakeem Adabudi, who I did an interview with 2 years ago here at Augustana, like these all were thinkers,
yeah.
but their thinking was pulled from the arts,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And I was wrong, by the way. It was Jane Kenyon. I shouldn't have said Mary, but I love Mary Oliver too.
Yeah.
And they're both great. But anyway, Jane Kenyon. And it just, it strikes me that if you, as an artist, as an educator, Aubrey Barnes, if you, when you see that you've put those words together,
mm-hmm.
how is it when you see that, because you do so much wonderful live performance, when you see the light in the eyes when they're getting it,
yeah.
How is that?
Man, it's you feel connected. You know, I think that's the one thing that art does, I think, that I've learned to like kind of pay attention to is that like art is there to connect us to each other, you know. It like regardless of like art's that one thing like we're saying, like when we think about transcendence, it transcends like these limitations of humanness that we've made. And like I could share a story and someone who's 80 years old, mm-hmm, who grew up mm-hmm, in the mm-hmm. countryside and doesn't know anything about my life can still connect with. So, you know, kind of seeing that light. And even here, it's more so, I get it more so when I hear the conversations after, when people come up to me and tell me how, like, my work, like, impacted them or how it made them think about their grandmother or think about their family upbringing and all that. And, like, that's always a reminder to me that, like, I'm following the flow of art well, you know, because I think that's what art does. Like it kind of, even in the practice of writing and all that, I take it very spirit, like it's a very spiritual practice of like, I'm very intentional with it and just kind of like sitting with it and allowing whatever is inspiring me to come outside of myself more than myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You don't want to let the ego get too much involved, but when you're able to like do that and let whatever force is speaking through you,
yeah.
you know that it did its job when it's connecting to somebody who you would never find yourself like talking yeah, to in a million yeah. years, but that connection was made through that creation of art, you know?
Yeah. I want to take advantage of your time with us,
Obs,
but I love to collect quotes.
Yeah.
And I keep them, I collect them thematically. Whenever I see a good one about poetry, I set it aside, but I love having the opportunity to speak to a real poet. And I say that with the greatest homage because you approach life poetically, which I really, really respect about you. But
I appreciate that.
I just want your take on some of these things. For instance, there's a woman named Lucille Clifton who said, one thing poetry teaches us, if anything, is that everything is connected.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of getting into that a little
yeah.
bit. And so that I thought we'd, first off, your take on that,
mm-hmm.
that observation.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with it's so I have a story with that
yeah.
too, that I kind of like think about like right when you kind of said that quote. There was a reading I was featured at in Cambridge, Iowa at one of my good friends, John Taylor, who does a lot of creative events out in Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
Or Bishop Hill, it was.
Yes, but, right. Know it well.
Yeah. And I did this poem talking about, like, reminiscing on how, like, my mom's ability to cook is her showing love. That's her love language and all
absolutely.
That, you know?
Absolutely.
And I was talking about it specifically from, like, the Black perspective, the mm-hmm. said Black perspective, right? And as I was going through this narrative, there was a woman who was sitting right in front who, as I was doing this poem, she said, oh, I relate to that too. And like, it was, again, like it was a woman who, again, from Cambridge, mm-hmm. Bishop area and all mm-hmm. that, completely like—
Not a lot of Black folks.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Yep, exactly. But she still connected with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, she connected with me mentioning the cast iron skillet, when I talked about the imagery of food and what that meant to me. There was a connection that was made between both of us. For me, like, it was in that moment, like you know, that made me realize, like, oh, like, this art is definitely a connecting force between peoples, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think all the time, even the creatives see it that way. I think sometimes as creatives, we want to, like, keep our art kind of pigeonholed into this, like, oh, well, this piece was for this sort of people I was writing for or these sort of people. I was like, it could still be that, but you can't ignore the fact of, again, the universal truth behind art that, like, it's all, there's going to be somebody who relates to it that you did not expect to relate to it, but that's the beauty of it, you know?
Well, one of the reasons I brought that one up in particular is because I would like to talk about your calling as an educator. So when you're dealing with young people, now you founded Young Lions Roar some years back, and we get a chance to glimpse that from time to time. Your amazing student who shared a poem through the Quad City Symphony Orchestra already this season, which I'd like you to talk about.
Yeah.
But also talking about, I think every young person can be a poet, but they don't believe it themselves. How do you illustrate for the students who maybe are a little more reluctant this idea of connectedness and universality?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because, like, even my job now as a creative educator, when I kind of juxtapose it to, like, how I was as a creative, I mean, as an educator in general, like, I've taught fourth grade, I've taught at-risk junior high and all that. It feels like being a creative educator, it feels like my job is easier than it was just being an educator, because, like, literally when I just give the opportunity, when I share with students what I do, you know, when I first kind of show them, allow them to hear my stories, you know, through poetry, when I allow them to kind of hear my narratives and all that, and then give them the unrestrained opportunity to create their own stories, you know. That's literally the recipe, you know? Like, it's literally, I think so much when we kind of think of it, because, again, when we think about writing and how we've kind of interpreted writing and how, and in turn, how writing's interpreted by educators to give to kids, like, it's very stripped of the things that we're talking about. Yeah. It's not really talked about as a science, as a moving transcendent force. It's more so, okay, it more so focuses on the very, like, left-brained things, like, oh, this is just like a descriptive language, you know, period here, comma here, make sure the words make sense, make sure the words are actually words, and I think all that, you know, it's good where it should be good at, but it strips away the magic that, like, writing can really be. So, like, I think when students kind of, like, are exposed to the opposite side of it, of like, hey, like, you write whatever you want, like, and if you spell a word wrong, did you understand the word? Great. You know, we'll get to that whenever. Did you make up a word? Great. You can make up a word here. Mm-hmm. Like, I've made up a bunch of words in poetry, you know, and when you kind of give sometimes, and I mean, sometimes it's like nerve wracking to students because, like, there's no rules. I'm like, not here. Like, you know, it's kind of nerve wracking for them to really, like, get into. But when they really kind of, like, take that, you know, initiative to just create and not think about it, you know, in and of themselves, they're tapping into that. You know, that creative transcendence we talk about, because they're creating and not thinking about it. They're just letting whatever force is in them write. And, like, after, sometimes they'll be like, I don't want to share, this is bad. But then when they share it, it's like, you just spoke a whole bunch of truth that all of us needed to hear, you know? So for me, it's just honestly just been the work of just, like, you know, continuing to show them, like, my work and continuing to just let them know, like, you know, that there's a world of writing outside of the world that we've kind of made it to be, which is still very important and all that. But, you know, it doesn't, the rules that you learn over here, they don't really apply as much over here. And if you add those rules, you just find yourself frustrated, writer's block and all these things. You know, it's just it's just what I've been learning in grad school. You know, you just write, you know, don't let yourself get so tight with the rules and all, you know.
Speaking of that opening of the channel, you know, and just saying, let it flow, right? Tell us about the young lion whose roar you helped us all here at the Quad City Symphony.
Oh, yeah, Zakiya Dade. Yeah, she's a special one. And it's funny because I went to school with her dad. So
really? See, isn't that what happens when you start getting older?
Yeah,
you know?
I've definitely accepted my role as, like, an uncle to students. Like, okay, I went to school with your dad, you know. But, yeah, she's a student I've been working with for, like, 3 years. And, like, she's, you know, the first time, like, we worked with her 3 years ago, she kind of, like, showed that, like, ability to and desire to write and to share and all that. So, like, I've just been the lucky person who's been able to, like, help hone her skills in that and kind of, like, allow. And by honing, like I said, it's just really just kind of, like, giving her things to think about that allows such a write. Because a lot of our sessions for Young Lions Roar, we're talking about stuff that the kids want to talk about. And always after, I have this phrase that they all know by heart. I'm like, well, you got 24 hours to write that now. Like, we had a whole 20-minute conversation about what you feel about school and mental health. 24 hours now. Yeah. You got your words and thoughts to play with. And she's just followed those, she's followed those objectives like well, know. And it led to her kind of like, for me, it led to her kind of like being chosen for not just the Rock Island, not just for the orchestra, but also for like, the Martin Luther King events that she's been able to like be acknowledged for in 2 times now. So,
well, the poem that the symphony chose to use is about her hometown, which is our hometown of Rock Island, right? And more broadly, the Quad Cities. And I'm so glad the symphony put it on a little bookmark. And so that I keep in the book that I read. So every night before I, pass out and my eyes cross, I get a chance to see.
That's awesome.
Fantastic. So we're talking about all kinds of things, which means it's a perfect time to talk about another person who was good at talking about all kinds of things. My guest this week is Aubrey Barnes, also known as Mr. Aubs, educator, poet, writer, reflector of our community. And another fellow who was pretty good at that was Dr. Roald Tweet. And this is the time each week when we get a chance to step aside and listen to Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. Several times a day, airplanes descend over Rock Island, riding the wind down toward the airport, 100 or 200 passengers at a time, returning home from the world, from Bangkok and Buenos Aires, Fiji and Frankfurt. Some of us haven't accepted the big birds in our hearts. We still hear lonesome train whistles late at night, or remember going down to the tracks each morning to watch the Burlington Zephyr snake along the Mississippi River toward Minneapolis. We kids put pennies on the train tracks, not out of disrespect, but to be awed by the power of the great engines as they flattened our coins into thin footballs. From the time we could first sing, we sang songs about trains. Name an airplane that has a single such song. We sang about working on the railroad all the livelong day. We sang an antiphonal response about Bill Grogan's goat tied to the tracks for eating shirts. We knew every verse of the Wabash Cannonball, its rumble and its roar. Here truly was an engine that could. We never tired of Casey Jones, who died a hero's death. In the beginning, airplanes had this same mystique and their own heroes. Amelia Earhart, Howard Hughes, Wiley Post, Jimmy Doolittle. But the airlines have gone antiseptic on us. What romance is there in a flight named 5168 compared to train runs such as the Rock Island's Gee Whiz to Kansas City, the Midnight Special, the City of New Orleans, or the Illinois Central's bright yellow Land of Corn? What cold maze of modern airline terminals can replace the rural depot and its pot-bellied stove, or the high-arched beehive temple that was Grand Central Station? All this reverie because last night a railroad song came back to me that was obligatory at every campfire I ever sat around. You remember it. The tune was humoresque. Passengers will please refrain from flushing toilets while the train is standing in the station. I love you. We encourage constipation while the train is in the station. Porters have to wait, so why can't you? How many crude verses of that song do you know?
Rock Island Lines with Roald Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we're able to hear Rock Island Lines thanks to folks just like you. As you know, WVIK kind of took a hit in the federal funding area, as did a lot of other folks. But we can help make sure that programs like Rock Island Lines are around and vital. You could do so by popping over to WVIK.org. And it's kind of hard to miss the bright red donate button. Well, my guest this week is Aubrey Barnes, the founder of Young Lions Roar, known as Mr. Aubs in many, many refined circles. And we're talking about poetry, the art of creativity, or the power of creativity, I should say, in rounding out an education and helping us confront a world that's not always that easy to face. And while we're talking about Tweet, I do want to, so one of Tweet's favorite poets, and one of mine too, was a guy named Art Mample. Now, he was based in the Seattle area. And one of the things I got to know him, and he was fascinating because he would spend hours walking around Lake Washington, which is out there, and memorizing poems, but also writing poems. And he would generally write a poem in his memory.
Wow.
Before he would commit it to paper. But this is one that's, he passed away in 2023. And it's a poem based on a little line by St. Paul in the Bible. The poem is entitled Before Winter. And the line was, that St. Paul was writing, is do your best to come before winter. And here's a poem. And I want you to know, Obbs, I'm going to put you on the spot because I want to hear your poetry before our time is done
here.
But this is Before Winter by Art Mample. Wait with me a while. When the air is cold and the shadows are longer, wait with me through the harsh night. When the soul is a dark figure and the mood is lonely, come at an inconvenient hour, just before you can, when the calendar will not permit, when your suddenness will sway the balance of things, but do not come when it suits you. Not when summer moves the beaches, not when the season is mellow, for then we shall likely trifle. Convenience is seldom the right visit, but we are made real by sacrifice. Isn't that something?
That's that last line, too, we're made real by sacrifice.
Isn't that great?
That is a good poem. Who is
Art Mample. Arthur Mample. I'll connect you with his works in a little bit. He wrote, he had several chapbooks of poetry, and he was a pastor in Seattle. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and his style of writing and living and everything else was, I really respect it, as I do yours.
Yeah,
so,
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Wow. But this notion of poetry helping us through difficult times. I'm going to drop a line from a former Quad Cities poet laureate. Her name is Rebecca Wee. And on that note, if anybody's listening, I think we need to restart the poet laureate program so that Mr. Obbs can be our next poet laureate. But Rebecca Wee once said, poetry is one of the most humane ways for us to cope with what we have no tools for.
Yeah. Absolutely.
How do you help young people appreciate that reality, that truth?
Yeah. You know, I think it kind of returns to like what I was saying earlier about kind of like, I think in anything, like we're like our lives are kind of like the best teachers, right? So in the sense of like, when I kind of think about art, like, the one way that I've inspired my students is like, is me kind of sharing the ways that I cope through my poetry. You know, when I kind of think about recent things like that we've kind of been able to connect over, it's just like grief. You know, I think like, it's been about 3 years since I had a younger brother pass away, you know, so like writing has been something that like, you know, grief, we kind of like Rebecca's quote, like we don't really, no, there ain't no college course or high school course of how to deal with grief, you know. You know, and I think sometimes like the mental and like kind of dealings with it, it's bigger than that, you know. And I think writing is one of those things that's kind of helped me kind of like deal with it in a way where it's like honest, where I'm sitting with feelings honestly, where I let feelings kind of like flood out. And I learned how to sit with them, you know. So like for me, I've shared those works with students and kind of told them kind of the isms, the narrative of like why these poems are written and all that. And it gives them all the more, you know, I had a whole conversation with one of my students because they had a dog pass away, you know, and I could feel like the heaviness and all that. So like, other than that, I dropped them off and I was like, before I dropped them off, I was like, hey man, like there's a power in crying. If you need to cry, like do that. Like, cause it's holding all the stuff inside. That's what we're taught to do, you know, but I'm here to tell you that that's a whole bunch of baloney. Like don't hold it inside. Cause that it just, you know, it's heavy. And he did that, and not only that, he wrote about it the next day, you know, because he saw my process, you know. He saw how I dealt with my grief and all that. So it was kind of like the catalyst to him being like, okay, maybe there's something in this for me to deal with my grief in the same way, you know. Because even a dog, like it's all life. Life is always, life is worth grieving over regardless of what it is. So, you know, that's the best way for me, just kind of like showing my life and how I use it to explain and deal with those things that are unnamed, you know, and showing them to how to do the same thing, you know.
Well, coming back to that whole notion of connectedness, you made me think of one of my favorite poems is by Garrison Keillor. It's called In Memory of Our Cat, Ralph. and talks about a childhood memory of coming home and discovering that the beloved family pet was no longer there.
Yeah.
And acknowledging how at one level isn't it rather nonsensical that we invest so much love in something we know has such a brief life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet that love is real.
Yeah.
And I'll connect you with that poem. You want to connect it with student, because that's some pretty powerful stuff. I want to get into the present beyond the educational role, but you are still performing, you are still creating.
Oh, absolutely.
What are some of the things that are capturing your attention and focus these days?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I just had one of my grad school courses, our last class we had, I think last week.
Mm-hmm.
And our last class was, so the last 5 weeks we've been kind of going through like students sharing their work and then other students giving their like review, thought, and feedback on it. So the last day I shared kind of like my work and all this. And both my professor and a student kind of pointed out the same things where like my work kind of feels like it's kind of on this like, it kind of is like this nuance of like talking about the realism of like certain things that happen on a social, political level.
Yeah.
But also also balanced with like the fantasy of like, you know, not as if it's not too heavy, you know,
mm-hmm.
like kind of
mm-hmm.
still having fun with the creativity, like making stories and narratives out of these deep things that happen. And I think for me, just going to this school, you know, that's really based on like meditation and training mm-hmm. and really just mm-hmm. intuitive thought. It's kind of shaped my work where like I've learned how to talk about the things that we experience, whether it be like locally, regionally, nationally, on a social political level, but like not being, yeah, and talking about uncomfortable truths and all that, but mm-hmm. having that written kind of like how spiritual teachers write them, like parables or like stories or mm-hmm. making narratives out of them that, mm-hmm. that are still kind of like captivating and fun to write. Cause mm-hmm. I think for me, like, I think as a writer, I'm always going to be I think I was just telling one of my friends a couple of days ago that like, I think as a creative, I believe we all have the duty to like talk about the things going on. Like, I think that's just an inherent duty that we all right. have to like, you know, answer the call to. Now, all of us don't, you know, and I don't fault the ones that don't. I just have to follow what I do, you know? So for me, I'm always going to have the task of like the self-endowed task of like talking about hard things and all that. But mm-hmm. I've learned that like, I'm not going to let it disrupt my peace though. At the end of the day, like, I don't want it to like make me where I'm like always paranoid or bitter or like irrationally angry about the things around me. Cause at the end of the day, I can only control myself. Like, so for me, I think a lot of my work has kind of been a capture of like the systemic things that we face, you know, as humans in this class war,
yeah.
this racial war
yeah.
and all that,
yeah.
and like making those truths known, but still understanding that like, I'm aware of this and yeah, it makes me angry from time to time. I should say for all the time,
yeah.
but I'm not going to let that consume the fact that like, I'm still a human being who can live in the life that I make for myself, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my work's kind of been just that nuance of like talking about the things that we experience, but also kind of making it like fun to hear,
yeah.
fun to write, you know, and really kind of easy to kind of take in. Cause like when you encounter truth, that's a little bit more like that. It's easier to be like, oh wow. Okay. Like mm-hmm. this is a very true thing, you know, as opposed to just having that really blatantly in your face and
yeah.
all that, which there's yeah. a time for that too, you know, but that just hasn't been my form of creativity or communication for the last couple of years, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm anxious to hear an example if you'd care to share, but as you're thinking about that, I think this is a really important calling you have because we live the affluent world, which is, you know, what we would call, I don't know, the first world or developed world or something like that. There was just a program on Hidden Brain about how, you know, so much of it is focused on distracting us
mm-hmm.
from difficult things, you know,
yeah.
and I see in my own life where I choose that distraction, you know, but it's imperative in a democracy, especially for engaged citizens to engage with the difficulty, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'm hearing what you're doing is helping to goad us towards those things that are more difficult to engage with and to do so with a sense of humanness, right? Is there a recent example you might care to share with us?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had a poem in mind, but I have a different poem, especially since this one's about Rock Island.
Okay.
And I shared this on a friend's platform not too long ago. I'm going to copy your lead and read it. I know a lot of my works is usually off mine, but I want to read this one.
Thank you.
But it's called Rock Island Sounds. So Rock Island sounds like window open to hear lullaby of train downtown with this long held half note of horn section that forgot when to pause between breaths that bowed heads at bedtime. A choir of cicadas singing from sunrise to sunset like a million light bulbs buzzing through window. And if you listen close enough, you can hear crickets whistling in between. Rock Island sounds like heavy Jordans clunking across concrete of kids and heavy-footed cadence that pick up tempo in tandem with neighbor whose familiar challenge never needs words, just a head start. Slow creeping of tires cross loose rocks falling from lips of potholes that city continues to ignore in some nights. Knuckleheads hit gas high off adrenaline of going 30 in a 10 out of 10 chance that a boy might cross the street, find himself crucified at crosswalk, casualty of foolish flex or fleet to beat a time that ain't worth rush, stopping hands before the time was ready. Rock Island sounds like echo of bullets that sound like they were forced from a pistol at spark of a barrel, blowing up as if peace wasn't the option. As if seeing black boys' life explode right before their eyes is just part of job of being police. Rock Island sounds like snores of heavy sleepers on 7th Street, rolling over in dirt beds outside of building blocks from foxes with dens, under trees with birds who have nests, yet sons and daughters of man have no place to rest head. Rock Island sounds like stomach rumble of starving artists who draw from poverty whatever art keeps them alive, even if sketch out of survival. Rock Island sounds like metal detector ding at dawn of school day, school security cops playing episode of school security cop copying episode of Cops, playing school to prison pipeline police to preteens as if track stars with criminal records, herding them through lines in contempt and wonder why they fight during the day. The battle is raged right when they walk through the doors. Rock Island sounds like it's willing to make compromise with capital, burn trees for dispensaries, even if it means stripping Mother Nature down without her consent. Rock Island sounds like axe swinging with ordinance that cuts down crops and food deserts cultivated by refugees that look foreign to farmers they in which aren't familiar, calling their irrigation an eyesore of agriculture, yet turn eyes from poison practices of private farms that fill Mississippi with sickness. Rock Island sounds like it lets so many outside voices inside of them that she's forgotten who she is. Rock Island sounds like loud screams from a glass jar she keeps lit over for the sake of seeming proper. Rock Island sounds like she's trying to do what's right, but been so lost in what sounds right that she doesn't know what's right anymore. Rock Island sounds like me, trying so hard to figure myself out, scared of accidentally saying yes to a no and never having a chance to take words back when I realize that I'm wrong. Either way, this body is one that I will wake up with when morning comes, where cicadas continue to sing, owls hoot through 9th Street in familiarity, deers walk down alleyways, curious of this place and if it's safe as we say it is. No matter how much of a mess I make in this vessel, I will always be expected to do the work, scrubbing my scars, cleaning up this act, treating this body more like present than play. For this body, born, raised, resident of Rock Island, are both one and the same. Home. That's a poem.
That was wonderful. First, thank you.
Thank you.
For sharing that. And I love the way you brought me in right in the first line, because I grew up about 6 blocks from the train tracks by the IH plant.
Yeah, yep.
And we didn't have air conditioning. So we would sit and listen at night to the old Rock Island lines thumping along.
Yeah, yep.
I do have a bit of a resentment because the new rail carrier on the Iowa side just likes to lay the horn on the whole time.
Yeah,
and it comes right in the window.
Yeah.
Right in the window. But you open with everything that unites and binds the cicadas. We all know the cicadas. And then you go into areas that may not be as familiar an experience to a person with my life experience. But of course, as a Rock Islander, I appreciate them and I understand the humanity of them.
Yeah.
And at the end, I'm just very grateful that I live in a complicated city.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to live in a city that allows me to be thoughtless.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's there's a lot of good stuff in there. I want to thank you for sharing that. My guest is Aubrey Barnes, amazing poet, and that is Mr. Aubs to many of the students whose voices he has unlocked. And I'm so grateful you did that. And I see right where that is tying into this calling of bringing attention to things, because it's just, you know, I'm not good at diagnosing, but I think a common theme behind a lot of the problems we have is that people have been lulled into sleepwalking.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't realize what they have to do as a citizen, as a person who is engaged in a community, in a nation, in a state, and everything else. So, and you bring to light another one of these quotes that I love is that you took me on a journey, and there's a Welsh poet named Danny Absey who once observed, "I hope to go into a poem sober and come out a little drunk."
Yeah, no, seriously.
That's, how do you like that?
I like that.
Isn't that a great one?
Yeah, because that's the whole thing. Like, I think writing is such a, like as we were kind of like been saying, like it's such a, to me, writing is in this present moment, it's a spiritual practice to me, in the sense of like when you're sharing it with someone, you want them to be like enchanted with this world that you're creating. You want them to like see what you're seeing or hear what you're hearing and like even feel what you're feeling, even if like you said, even if they don't have never been in the narrative in which you're experiencing something, they feel it on a deep level that they can't really explain it. Mm-hmm. Kind of returning back to that Rebecca quote and all that, you know, I think that's the power of creativity when you can be so like in the present of your work where like, you know, the people, they leave said drunk, you know, they leave like, wow, what just happened? What did I feel? And all that. I think that's the beauty of it. Cause I know when I listen to my favorite poets, that's what I'm feeling, you know?
Who are some of your favorite poets whom you might recommend we learn more about?
Oh yeah. So I'm grateful to like say like a lot of them are my friends, you know?
Yeah. That's fantastic.
So, the first poet that comes to mind is one of my good friends, Artemis Cadwell. He's from St. Louis, but he is an amazing, amazing storyteller. Like his ability to storytell is like he draws you into a story, like emotionally, like cognitively, and just like I bring him down pretty often from St. Louis to here. So like if you want to check him out at Roaring Rhetoric, definitely come to our open mics. But he's an amazing storyteller. So he's one of the first ones that come to mind.
So before we go any further, though, you mentioned Roaring Rhetoric. So is there a website where we can keep tabs on these things that are happening?
Yeah. So we're actually building the website now, but we have like a Facebook page.
Okay.
Roaring Rhetoric, where we post all our events. And we're actually going to be posting pretty soon in the next couple of days, like all the events for the whole year. So people just know like.
Yeah.
But then also like whenever month comes, we're going to have the flyer, but just so people know like these are the dates and all that. So we're having a lot of really cool poets come down.
That's
I'm really
fantastic.
Excited for it. Really cool poets. But yeah, so Artemis is one.
Okay.
And outside of my friend group, I had to say Propaganda, also known as his name's Jason Petty, but he's from California. He's an amazing poet, activist, just creative all together. And like he's someone who's influenced me for the last 11 years of my creative journey and just how he writes. Mm-hmm. It's just very human, but very honest too. So he's a great writer as well. So between those two, those are two pretty good poets, Artemis Cadwell and Propaganda.
There's something about how poetry takes snapshots of our lives by the way we resonate with it. And it was funny as I was thinking about our time together this Saturday, Aubrey, I went back and I keep a file of quotes. I also keep a file of poems because if something shows up and I think I better hold on to that, right? I was kind of shocked by this. I found a poem that I had saved in February of 2005. because you know I'm an old guy, by Naomi Shihab Nye, a very well-regarded poet. And what I found, I'm not going to read the poem to you, it's entitled So Much Happiness, okay? And I looked at the date on the file. I saved that file 1 month almost to the day before my father passed, very unexpectedly, which was one of the sadder events, one of the most bereft of happiness events that I've encouraged in times and periods in my life. And I just tried to... I tried to transcend, to use your word, where I was now and remember where I was in February of 2005 when the universe in had a different reality than it does now. And you talked about your brother who passed. And I wonder if you go back and see poems in a different light that may have been written from before that terrible tragedy and now in the new reality, the reality without that.
No, I often do, for sure. Like, it's a practice I make to kind of, like, to return to those poems and all that. And it's just a, I think, like, it's a reminder. I think when grief kind of happens of any kind and all that, there's a part of us that kind of dies with that person and all that. And, you know, I think that kind of varies on the proximity of that person, you know. Like, father to son, that's a very close proximity where, like, you know, there's a part of you that feels like it passes away with that person. With me and my brother, there was an identity that passed away, like, you know, on a physical level of, like, oh, like, I'm an older brother to one less sibling. And that means some of these roles, you know, you kind of lose yourself, you know. I kind of, like, so for me, like, the before poems are kind of, like, me in this, like, you know, it's just being, writing from a space before grief, you know, and I think how grief has really impacted my writing on kind of like a silver lining sense is that it just made me realize that, like, it's made me really meditate on the uncertainty of life, really, all the more, like, where like, I'm always telling people, like, on a day-to-day basis that, like, and it's even why I don't really, like, I plan for the present. I don't really plan for the future because I'm like, the future, so we don't know what's going to happen in the future, you know? So, like, the only thing I base my living on is the present moment, you know, and that's that really kind of changes the scope of my writing because I'm very cognizant of what's happening in the present moment, like the conversation I'm having. Because it's again, like, oh, this could be the last time I have this conversation, or last time I see this person, or last time I experience this laugh. So I'm like, I want to encapsulate all of this into my writing, however best way I can. You know, you saw that in the Rock Island, the Sounds of Rock Island poem. I'm encapsulating all these sounds, things I'm seeing, you know, and all this. Cause it's like, and I think that's all a product of, like, understanding that, like, life's so uncertain. So I want to be able to capture all the things that I can and have that translated in a way where, like, you know, it's felt, you know.
Well, I don't know that much about philosophy, but I do know just enough about the Stoics to know that they helped me realize that we don't really begin to appreciate the moment we're in until we begin to appreciate the finitude of the number of moments we have.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And whether it comes unexpectedly or otherwise, we don't know how that's all going to come together.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we are on December 27th, and is there something coming up close that we might be able to check out that's on your mind and your radar screen in terms of poetry?
Yeah, our next event locally is actually gonna be really it's gonna actually be through our open mic that we're restarting back for next year. We take a 2 month hiatus every year, so, but that one's gonna be January 30th.
January 30th.
Yep, at Skylark Studios.
And Skylark on 7th and 44th. See, that's right where I grew up. That's what you're talking about right there.
That's perfect.
And so, again, we could check out the Facebook page, Roaring Rhetoric. And right now, though, I can't believe we ran out of time.
Again. Oh, wow.
So you're going to have to come back some other time,
too. Look at that.
Please let me thank my guest, Aubrey Barnes. Mr. Aubs, thank you for all that you do in our community.
Yeah, thank you, Kai. Thank you
for really
this.
Appreciate it. So checking out the forecast just a little bit. Well, it's going to be kind of weather this weekend, but then things will get a little bit nicer here. So just stay tuned. It'll all be good one way or another. Hey, ahead on WVIK, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And be sure to join us next week when we're going to try something different, a throwback show, some of the old comedy bits you remember from days gone by. And that'll be right here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. You can always find our podcast at WVIK.org or tune in to Quad Cities NPR, WVIK 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island. and at 95.9 FM K240DZ in Dubuque. We're coming up on 11 o'clock. We'll get a little news from NPR in Washington on your public radio station, WVIK. Then it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Friends, thanks for tuning in.